Hello and welcome to episode 382 of the UK True Crime Podcast. I'm Adam. As this is part two of a two-part story, the first one was last week. If you haven't listened to last week's episode, I strongly suggest you do before you listen to this one. There's no month and year game today, and also no advert. I know, gutted, huh? On the subject of adverts, if you're interested about what adverts you sometimes hear on this and other podcasts, I recorded a short video about this last week. Just go to YouTube and search UK True Crime Live. Why not subscribe while you are there? So as well as the 64 videos, you can see all the new ones as I post them. So last week's story began on the 31st of January 2019 at Hull University. 21-year-old Libby Squire, who was studying philosophy at Hull, had been out with her friends that evening as usual, but had been refused entry to the nightclub. Her friends put her in a taxi home and paid the fare, but although the taxi dropped her at her house, she walked off in the opposite direction and she never made it home. Detectives used CCTV to trace a man whose car Libby got into, married father of two 26-year-old Pavel Relovich. He had driven to nearby Oak Road playing fields with Libby, but when he got back in the car, Libby hadn't been with him. Detectives believed he'd sexually assaulted and then killed Libby there. And although they strongly suggested that Libby had been murdered, there was no body. Detectives believed that Libby's body had been put into the River Hull, which ran directly past Oak Road playing fields. But as we know from recent high-profile cases, a body in a tidal river can never resurface, or it could be swept out to sea by strong currents and never seen again. But when Relovich was taken in for questioning, he denied having anything to do with Libby's disappearance. When arrested, detectives found he owned a pink holdall containing sex toys, female underwear, and photographs of women, all of which he'd stolen in recent burglaries. And his saliva and his semen were found on some of the items. And when his DNA was put through the system, it was also clear that Relovich had been carrying out a number of offences against women close to where he lived for a couple of years, and eventually he admitted 9 charges of voyeurism, burglary, and outraging public decency between June 2017 and December 2018, just a month before Libby went missing. One of these victims was engaged in an intimate act with her boyfriend when she saw him spying on them through an open window. He was seen spying on another woman when she got out of the shower a few months later. A third woman told how he was staring at her, just inches from her bedroom window, when she was wearing only a sports bra and pajama bottoms. The same woman was terrified when she saw hands coming through her letterbox weeks later. This again was Relovich. And then in a clear escalation, on one occasion he masturbated in front of two women on the street whilst looking directly at them, and another time he masturbated just a few metres away from two women and then followed them, ejaculating over the front door of their house. The women said he didn't seem the slightest bit concerned that he'd been spotted by them. He'd also committed these burglaries, seemingly also with a sexual motive. Among the items stolen in the burglaries were 3 vibrators from a property in Hull in December 2017. He also admitted stealing £148 in cash from the home of a mum who found an unwrapped condom in her living room next to a child's toy. He'd ignored items worth considerably more, like a laptop. Relovich faced court for these crimes in August 2019, and he was sentenced to 8.5 years in prison. The judge said, "Every single one of these crimes has a sexual undertone," and he detailed just how violated his victims felt. And let's go into a touch more detail about exactly how they did feel. Let me quote from the BBC, who spoke to the first victim of Relovich. Sarah, not her real name, was sharing a moment with her boyfriend. It was a July evening in 2017, and the window of her downstairs bedroom at the front of a shared student house was slightly open. Suddenly the room brightened with the light from an outside street lamp, and she looked up to see the terrifying sight of a man's hands and face poking through the curtains. Seconds later, Sarah's then partner also turned to look at the window. This startled the unwanted spectator, who fled. Then 3 hours later, at about 4 a.m, her housemate returned home from a shift at a local bar to find a used condom and a pair of warm black lacy knickers hanging on the front door handle. Sarah said the reaction from those around her to what had happened initially led her to feel as though she was blowing out of proportion. "I don't think my boyfriend took it very seriously. My housemates didn't take it seriously. I think they just thought it was funny, but I didn't find it funny at all. Everyone else had played it down, but I knew something was very wrong." The police response when she first reported the issue further compounded this feeling. She was very unimpressed when officers arrived a day later to take fingerprints, only after her mum, herself a former policewoman, had nudged them into doing so. And let's go to David Wilson to explore this further. You will know he's a criminology professor, and he made some interesting comments about the nature of these offences and how voyeurism in particular has been treated in the UK. He said, "It wasn't so long ago that peeping Toms would feature on so-called humorous postcards that you would send to family and friends when you were visiting the seaside. Culturally, we've not taken the behaviour of voyeurism seriously for a very long time. There's a tendency to think of the peeping Tom almost as an insignificant, joke-like character, whereas they cause a great deal of harm and hurt. They are predatory sexual offenders and should be treated as such. A fair point, I think, don't you?" And let's quote a bit more from Sarah about how this crime affected her after the event. "Within days, she had the locks changed and a small CCTV camera installed with help from her parents. But that did not stop her from feeling absolutely petrified, particularly when she was alone in the house. At one point, she recalls keeping a set of gardening shears under the bed just in case. I'd lock my bedroom door at night and I wouldn't even leave to go to the toilet. I had a summer job and I ended up quitting and going back to my family home because I couldn't be in that house. And when I went back in September, that's when it started up again. It became this massive fear." Sarah says she remained very, very frightened for nearly a year. She recalls several times experiencing a sudden, intense burst of fear, as she put it, when walking at night. Professor Wilson says Relevich's actions were all about having power over his targets. "It's not about him trying to express himself sexually because he's got some kind of fetish," he said. "He wants to be powerful and he gets off, as it were, simply when he sees the reaction of people watching him behaving the way that's been described. He wants somebody to be shocked and annoyed and scared because ultimately that makes him feel more than he actually is." Professor Wilson continued that this problem didn't just start last month or 6 months ago. "The problem has been in his background for years and it's been allowed to go untreated." But back to Libby Squire. The CCTV that was found shortly after Libby was left at the playing fields actually showed Relevich masturbating in the middle of the street after he'd left her. A condom found at the scene days later yielded a DNA profile matching his. 7 weeks after Libby disappeared, fishermen found a body in the Humber estuary, which was identified as Libby. Due to the time the body had spent in the water, it was inconclusive whether she was alive or not before entering the water. Also, her exact cause of death couldn't be determined. The pathologist said that small hemorrhages found around Libby's mouth could represent squeezing or compression of the neck or covering of the mouth, but the lacerations could be caused in water or in life near the time of death. Toxicology tests showed she had almost 200 milligrams of alcohol in 100 millilitres of blood. The legal limit is, of course, 80. Sperm cells matching Relevich's DNA profile were found in swabs taken from inside her body. The pathologist added that hypothermia, drowning, or asphyxia were all possible causes of death, but the actual cause remained unascertained. Meanwhile, at the police station, Relevich was struggling with the truth and he gave 5 varying accounts of his encounter with Libby to the police and his friends, and later to the court. Once Libby's body had been found and it was clear there had been sexual contact between Libby and Relovich, his story changed again. Witnesses had come forward to say that Relovich told them that he offered a lift to a girl at a bus stop and she tried it on with him. Eventually, he told officers that he met Libby and they had consensual sex at the playing fields, and then he left her there completely unharmed. He said he didn't hear the 4 to 7 minutes of screaming coming from a woman at the playing fields at exactly that time that a local resident had heard. He explained to officers that he was driving around the Hull student area as he was, I quote, looking for a woman to have easy sex on the night of the 31st of January. But he said that when he found Libby drunk and distressed, he just wanted to help her, which officers found incredibly difficult to believe, as Libby fitted just what he was seemingly looking for. Relovich said that when they met, she asked for a hug and they ended up kissing before they had sex on the ground near his car. He continued that she had tried to kiss him again, but he turned away and she scratched his face. He said he then drove away and saw her behind his car shouting at him not to leave her. When asked why he hadn't told the police this when he was arrested, he said, "It was not a deliberate decision. I had 2 children and a wife. I didn't want her to find out I had cheated on her. I didn't do anything to Libby. I didn't kill her. I didn't rape her. And I left her where I said I left." Detectives didn't believe him and he was sent to trial charged with murder and rape, both of which he denied. During the trial, prosecutor Richard Wright QC said Relovich had spent the night of the 31st of January 2019 driving around, effectively looking for a woman to attack. He was circling the area and effectively on patrol, looking for an opportunity to present itself to him. Wright continued that after he'd met Libby, he drove her to the playing fields, where he launched an act of sexual violence, which culminated in his putting her, dead or dying, into the cold waters of the River Hull that bordered the edge of the playing fields. It was from there that Libby's body travelled into the Humber and then out almost to sea to be recovered by the lifeboat on the 20th of March, he said. Prosecutors told how he repeatedly lied to police, his wife, and in court documents about what happened on the night of Libby's disappearance. As is often the case, the trial revealed many unpleasant points about the defendant. In this case, it was revealed that at the beginning of one police interview in August 2019, an officer put it to Relovich that the only reason she is dead is because you killed her. He sniggered. The officer asked him why he was laughing. The jury was told that the officer then asked the defendant, "What's so funny? And why are you smirking?" The prosecutor told the jury that Relovich replied, "No comment." Closing the case, QC Wright asked the jury whether Libby would really have said to Relovich, "I'll lie down on this scrap of grass in the snow, in the cold, not in the warm car, and I'll have unprotected sex with you here and now." "It is, we suggest in common sense, a nonsense proposition," said Wright. He told the court that Relovich was no knight in shining armour when he came across Libby on Beverly Road. He was looking for a woman to satisfy his problem, to satisfy his sexual urges. At the end of the trial, Relovich was found guilty on both counts and sent to prison for a minimum of 27 years. Referring to his perverted campaign of sexually deviant behaviour, the judge said he was a very dangerous individual. She told him that prior to the murder, your offending escalated, you grew increasingly emboldened, no doubt you were increasingly confident you would not and could not be caught. Addressing the court, Libby's mum Lisa said that no words could explain the torture of living without my Libby. "Not only have I lost my firstborn child with whom I had an amazing bond, but I've also lost the possibility of being a grandmother to her children," she said. "Knowing that in Libby's last hour of life she needed me, but I wasn't there for her, will haunt me for the rest of my life. Because of what happened that night to Libby, I now live in 2 worlds. One where I'm a mother, wife and employee. But then there is a dark and lonely world. In this world I long to die, so I can be with my girl one more time. The police, as you may expect, took some stick after the case for their investigation. Unfairly so, I would suggest. Radovich had no convictions before Libby went missing, so the police didn't have his DNA or fingerprints to compare with evidence found at those crime scenes. Officers said they didn't have the forensic evidence they needed to conclude that the crimes were all carried out by the same offender. Of Radovich's 9 convictions, police said that 2 of the incidents only came to light after Libby's disappearance. Nevertheless, Humberside Police's Professional Standards Department looked into whether the incidents were properly investigated at the time they happened, and they concluded that in this case they were. A couple of years after his conviction, Radovich agreed to meet Libby's mum Lisa as part of a restorative justice programme, but then he changed his mind, claiming he was appealing his conviction and sentence. Incidentally, no appeal is yet forthcoming. I find it really sad and upsetting. Why lead the mum on and say he's going to see her when I'd imagine he'd no intention? Is it just another form of control, I wonder? When Lisa was asked by the BBC why she'd want to meet her daughter's killer, she said, "It's about being in the same space as the person who was last with her. In an ideal world, I'd love him to tell me how she died, because we still don't know, and it's a question that does not leave me." She admits she doesn't think that he would say honestly how she died, but Lisa stated, "It's more for me about how she was feeling when she got into the car. Was she evidently warmer? Was she chatty? Was she quiet? Was she crying or was she not crying? All those little questions that just eat away at me." So sad to hear, isn't it? All those questions going over and over in her mind. One other point I think we should return to is another person inadvertently involved in events of that night. Still deeply affected by what happened to Libby is a taxi driver who picked her up on the night she was killed, Steve. He's naturally reflected on what happened once he dropped Libby off. He said, "Obviously you look back and you think maybe I should have gone round again and checked on her. But then there's only so much I can do as a taxi driver without incurring any consequences." It's true, I think, don't you? So what do you make of what we've heard today? The first thing I really want to say is that although Libby was a little drunk and distressed on a freezing cold night in Hull, and potentially hypothermic, it said as well, which may have affected her decision making, there is no fault at all for what happened with her or any of the other people who she saw after she arrived at the Welly nightclub. I've put myself in more vulnerable situations in the past, as I'm sure you have, and yet we were fortunate to make it home and live another day. I've heard and read the bouncers at the club blamed. They had a duty of care, it said. I've heard her friends should have gone back with her. The taxi driver should have looked after her. The people she met after the taxi dropped her should have made sure she was okay. But in fact, the only person responsible for what happened to Libby is Radovich. It's just him. It is, of course, easy for us to see how his offending was progressing and escalating. Even so, to go on to murder is shocking. And the sheer circumstances of a predator looking for a stranger, a woman to assault or expose himself to, is pretty shocking, isn't it, on that freezing cold winter's night. Surely he will never be released, so it's a long time to reflect on his actions. I can't even imagine how that feels, but quite frankly, I don't care. We've spoken about him enough, I think. We can have no sympathy for him, but we certainly can for his wife, who was seemingly unaware they were building their family together. And now she's moved away from the area, which of course she had to. She had no other option. And her 2 children will one day find out about their dad, just who he is and what he did. And they'll have to live with that. But of course our real sympathy lies for all the people affected by Libby's loss. Those people who met her or spent some time with her in the hours before her death, who will always wonder if there was more they could have done, although the answer is of course no, but it's just human nature to do so, isn't it? But most of all, we feel for her friends, her boyfriend and her family. I don't know what you think. I think Libby just sounds lovely. And after a tough few years, she was thriving at university, enjoying herself, living her best life and looking forward to the future. But due to the actions of one evil, predatory man, she was stopped from fulfilling her immense potential. How does that possibly feel to lose somebody in these circumstances who had so much to live for? Our hearts go out to all those who are close to Libby. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of the UK True Crime Podcast. To discuss this story and any other aspects of UK True Crime, please head to Facebook and join over 94,000 of us who talk UK True Crime 24/7. We really do. Why don't you pop over, take a look today. And to support the show, please head to patreon.com/UKTrueCrime. There's bonus episodes, 74 of them, and loads of other exclusive content. And remember, the draw, the competition, the latest competition for the two criminology courses featuring Professor David Wilson, who we heard from in the episode today, worth £149 each, will be this Sunday. That'll be the draw. So please make sure you join us before then. A huge thank you to the latest members of this community. That's Jen D, Jenny Brooks, David Thomas and Susie P. Thank you all so much. Your support is so much appreciated. So if you're not supporting me at Patreon yet, please do join our community at patreon.com/UKTrueCrime and help me to release free weekly content. You know it makes sense. Okay, so that's all for me, the host of the UK's 37th most popular true crime podcast for another week. Please do head to YouTube, you get a sec, search UK True Crime Live, see my video about the mystical world of podcast advertising. So until we speak again next week, please do take it easy and remember, despite all the others, it's always the others. Stay classy. Cheerio for now.